The Tom Woods Show, episode 812.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, don't be envious of me just because I'm getting the best shave of my life. Join me. Get your free trial set from Harry's. That's a razor, five-blade cartridge, and shaving gel. Plus, they're tossing in a post-shave balm. And all you got to do is pay three smackers for shipping. So head over to harrys.com. That's H-A-R-R-Y-S.com. And enter code Woods. Hello, everybody. Tom Woods here. By popular demand, an episode on Augusto Pinochet in Chile. There's controversy about him. Even among libertarians, when you look at his record, you can say Chile became a far more livable place than its neighbors, and it has a lot to boast about. But at the same time, you have the Pinochet human rights record to reckon with. So how are we to make sense of this period in history? Joining me to answer that question is Axel Kaiser, who is the executive director of the Chilean think tank Fundación para el Progreso. You can find out more about that over on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/812. Axel, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Tom. It's a pleasure.
I've been looking for somebody to talk to me about Pinochet for a while, but I haven't known who the appropriate person is. So you are the lucky winner, my friend. Congratulations. I'd like to just guide us through the relevant topics. I will say that when I visited Chile back in, I guess it was, 2008. It's been a while, or 2009. So somewhere between 2008 and 2009, I visited. And I had a great time. But my perception was that even to this day, people in Chile are very divided over regarding their views of Pinochet and his legacy. Is that a correct impression on my part?
That's a correct impression, Tom. And you know, We were on the verge of a civil war in 1973 when Pinochet took over power, you know, and Allende killed himself. Some people think that he was killed by the Chilean military. Actually, he shot himself with an AK-47 that was given to him by Fidel Castro himself when he came to Chile after Allende had been elected. So we were on this Cold War logic. And in the end, the anti-communist forces and anti-totalitarian forces prevailed, which does not justify what happened later. But the country is still divided. You have to keep in mind that Pinochet, after 17 years in government, he had this referendum, yes or no referendum, where he reintroduced democracy. But the question was if he stayed as president with an elected parliament and everything, or he had to go home. He lost, but with 44% of the votes. We don't have to forget that. So he was very popular among the Chilean population, and this is a fact, even today.
All right. So these are the sorts of things I want to dig more deeply into. Let's begin with the history. The version of events that most people are familiar with, or most people have been led to understand, is as follows, that you had the democratically elected Allende, and then you had Pinochet, who took over, and possibly with the connivance of the CIA. And this is because you had a progressive in power, and Americans and right-wingers just can't tolerate having a progressive in power who's going to restore power to the people. That's the version of events that we have heard. How much of that is true?
I think that's a lot of fiction, Tom, because the truth is that Chile was, you know, as most of the world, battlefield, if you want, from in times of the Cold War. So the Soviet Union was actively supporting the Allende regime. And actually, Allende was an informant to the KGB. He had been an informant to the KGB since the 1950s. So, and he got a lot of money from the KGB for his own campaign. And it is true, he was elected with 36% of the votes, no? And in the election of 1970. And what happened was that he brought a Marxist revolutionary program, which he claimed he wanted to install in Chile through democratic means. So Allende was the first Marxist president that was ever democratically elected in the world. Typically, Marxist leaders came through the violent means to power, revolutions and things like this. And so when Allende was elected, Henry Kissinger said that this was one of the greatest threats to the Western Hemisphere that had happened, because, of course, this was a very dangerous president, that a Marxist president could be elected, democratically elected. This was a legitimacy that Marxist communist movements didn't have so far. So it is true that the CIA intervened, but it is also true that the KGB was intervening and massively in Chile as well. So it is only a one-sided story what you hear. And then no one tells you why Fidel Castro spent a complete month in Chile after Allende was elected. And no one tells you that, the Soviet Union was even prepared to send heavy weaponry to the communist cause in Chile. And Pinochet was appointed commander-in-chief by Allende himself. So Pinochet was an enigma from an ideological perspective. And typically, military people are very statist-oriented. They are not, at least in Chile, they are not really free marketeers or something like this. So in the end, what happened was that the whole population rebelled, because the situation in Chile was very similar to what is going on right now in Venezuela. So people didn't have things to eat. We had huge queues. We had more than 3,000 prices that were fixed by the government. Private firms were confiscated, land, everything. So the country was an economic catastrophe. And in the end, the people rebelled, and the armed forces took over power after they were called by the Chilean parliament. This is something that people don't know. In August 73, in the year 1973, the Chilean deputies chamber, with 2/3 of the votes, called to the military to put an end to the Allende regime, because they accused him of trying to install a totalitarian Marxist dictatorship in the country. And this is a historic document. You can read it. I'm not making this up, you know. And so after that, on September 11, actually, was the coup d'etat in Chile. And these are parts of the story that people have to know, because it's much more complex than what you get on television and all these people that have not really read the story.
Salvador Allende was elected in 1970, so he was in power for just about 3 years, right?
And right.
So you've already described a little bit of what life was like, but let's talk a little bit more about his time in office. And what I mean, because in other words, there are going to be people who will say everything he did, he was just, sure, of course, the moneyed interests aren't going to like it, the imperialists aren't going to like it, but he was simply doing what was best for the people who are always and everywhere terribly exploited. How can you show that that's not correct?
Well, you have to look at the numbers. We had 1,000% inflation, year adjusted inflation in 1973. We had scarcity of all basic goods, you name it, you know, from rice to bread to anything you want, meat, whatever, milk. We didn't have these things. We had government was completely bankrupted by these policies of printing money and spending money and all this. You know, industries were confiscated and they were not working. I don't know any Chilean left-wing economist, serious left-wing economist, who would agree with the statement that Allende had a reasonable economic management of the country. No one in Chile, not even left-wing economists, maybe some Marxist economists, even today defend Allende, but not the left-wing serious economist, defend the economic management of the Allende regime. They all have written, I have read papers, books, and they all admit that the economic management, the socialist central planned economy that he tried to introduce in Chile, was a disaster for the average Chilean person. And this is the reason why, in the end, he was not deposed by the military. People massively went to the streets, the several, you know, organizations of the civil society, all of them were against the Allende regime, because not only violence was escalating, but also we had this economic disaster that people could not live with. You know, older people even nowadays remember that they didn't have milk for their babies and all these things. And of course, what was the other side's argument? It was that greedy capitalists and, you know, CIA agents were taking all the food away. And we're leaving people with no basic goods to satisfy their needs. But, of course, this is the same nonsense we hear in the Venezuelan case. Of course, you know, you see Maduro saying all the time, no, this is, you know, the fault of capitalists and the U.S. and all these imperialists. And we all know that's nonsense. So so in the end, and this is even former Allende friends would admit this, he was deposed, he was overthrown, because people didn't want him anymore. And this is the not the narrative that left-wing intellectuals across the Western world want to hear, because they have, you know, created their own narrative, which is not necessarily based on the crude reality. And the crude reality is that Allende was not a man of the people. He was first from the upper higher class, and secondly, he failed to the people because he did not deliver the socialist paradise where everyone was going to be equal and have plenty of everything that he had promised. And this is the reason why he was, in the end, overthrown by the military, yes, but after the same parliament that had been elected by the people called the military to overthrow him. So it's much more complex than people think.
How long would people have had to wait for the next election if this particular way of solving the problem hadn't taken place? When was the next election?
A couple of years. I think it was in 75, because these were six-year periods of time, of you know, presidential periods. So three more years maybe with Allende on running the government. But this was impossible, because within the Allende coalition, you had the Communist Party, the Socialist Party, very radical movements that wanted the to introduce a dictatorship right away, and others wanted a more gradual change. So within the Unidad Popular, which was called the coalition, the popular unity, or I don't know how to translate that exactly, but you had enormous clashes and divisions. So Allende lost control of the situation completely, not only of the country. He was not running the country anymore, but of the political situation. He was so desperate that he was the first one to call the military to form part of his government. He appointed some generals as ministers in order to bring order to a country that was derailed. And in the end, he even lost the support of the Soviet Union and of the people and everyone. So what happened in 1973 was, I think, to some extent inevitable, because the situation was so disastrous that there is no way that the country would have resisted three more years with such a mismanagement and with 1,000% inflation and all that. And Chile, you know, has a different history than other countries in Latin America. We have been historically the most stable country in political terms. We had an ancient democracy in the sense that we had had for democracy for over 100 years. And our stability was much greater than if you go to the Caribbean or if you go to Venezuela or other countries. So we were not used to this kind of disaster. We have some episodes, of course, in our past, but other countries have had this more often than we had. So Chilean people don't like this. They don't tolerate this mismanagement, this chaos, basically. And that's why even today, Tom, even today, if you go to take a look at the surveys, the most respected institutions among Chilean people are the armed forces and police. It's incredible. After everything that happened, and this is a puzzle to many people, but it's because Chileans don't like this kind of chaotic situations, and then they resort to a strong person or guy who can bring back order. And I have to repeat, Pinochet, he obtained 44% of the votes in after 17 years of dictatorship. And this is something that people should really think about. It's not nothing. I mean, it's an important part of the electorate that gave him their support after 17 years. Many democratic leaders would want to get 17% after 17 years, and they don't get it. So this is not justifying anything, but it's explaining the historical situation.
All right, now we have to get into Pinochet himself. Before we do that, let's thank our sponsor. Folks, here's a special message just for the men in the audience. And if my demographic surveys are telling me the truth, that's about 93% of you. Well, chances are you're a shaver like me. And I don't know if you've had the bad fortune that I have when shaving with a blade, but I gave it up years ago because I wound up looking like I'd just been attacked by an axe murderer. I never look good. I'm a bloody mess, and I didn't know what I was doing wrong, and I'm doing everything they're telling me to do, and it's just terrible. So I gave it up. So I used electric, but we all know that's not as close, and I just didn't know what to do. Meanwhile, everybody else is running around with these faces that look like babies' bottoms. How are they doing this? So I finally decided, what the heck, I'll give it another try. Why not? I'm 44. I'll try something new. So I checked out Harry's at harrys.com, and sure enough, I'm actually getting a smooth shave, and I'm not all hacked to bits, and I actually look like a reasonable person now. How about that? Well, check out what I did by trying out Harry's yourself. In fact, sign up for one of their shave plans, and they will send you their free trial set for just a $3 shipping charge. That includes a razor, a five-blade cartridge, and a shaving gel, and plus, use code WOODS at checkout, and they'll throw in a post-shave balm for free. So come on now. Be like Tom Woods. Check out harrys.com. Use coupon code WOODS and get your goodies. All right. Who is Pinochet? 1973 rolls around. Who is this man? Had anybody ever heard of him?
He was really not very well known. He was not very important figure within the military. He had not been a great student. He had not been someone who would call your attention because he was very vocal in any respect. He had no known ideology. This is incredible. No one knew if he was left-wing. As I said, Allende himself appointed him a commander-in-chief of the armed of the army, basically. And so he was no one special, so to speak. When he had to act, he even hesitated because the guys who really wanted the coup and who really pushed for the coup after what happened with the deputy's chamber were the guys from the Navy, Merino. And Pinochet was the last one to say, okay, I'm with you and I'm determined to put an end to this regime. No, he was the last guy to say, okay, we go for this. And when he came to power, of course, because the army is the strongest branch of the armed forces, he was elected the president of the junta because we didn't have a unipersonal dictatorship like Cuba had with Fidel Castro. We had a junta, which means that the commander-in-chief from the four branches of the armed forces were the legislative body, and they were making the decisions together. And they were blocking each other sometimes. This is really interesting. So this was Pinochet. He was nothing special. And when you really read his biography, you find this. He was not a known socialist. He was not a known anti-socialist. He was nothing special. But then he played this major role in history. And of course, when he came to power, the first 2 years, he tried to manage the economy in the way that had been managed the last 50 years. We had this import substitution system, so very protectionist economies and socialist economy, and he failed. So Milton Friedman and Arnold Harberger came to Chile in 1975, March, if I'm not mistaken, and they wrote some analysis about the situation of the economy in Chile, and Friedman even met with Pinochet for 45 minutes. And he told him how to correct the inflationary problem and to apply this shock therapy and all this. And so Pinochet listened to them. And because he was a pragmatic and not an ideologue, he applied these reforms and the economy started growing. And that was the origin of the so-called Chilean miracle. And we had these Chicago boys, these Chicago-trained economists that came to Chile, and then they made all these reforms. And they have also been very heavily criticized for taking part in this regime. But the fact is that that the economy started growing, and nowadays we have the same system, more or less. Chile is the wealthiest country in Latin America. So from that perspective, he was not wrong we could say, because if you compare his economic legacy with the economic legacy of other dictators in Latin America, there is no question. Even Paul Krugman admits in one of his books that the reforms that were introduced in Chile were successful. So I think from that perspective, he made good decisions. Of course, we had the whole other part, which is the darkest part, which has to do with human rights abuses and all that. But as I said, he was nothing special. And I don't think he ever imagined that he would have the chance of playing this role in Chilean history.
I do want to get to the human rights abuses in just a moment, but just another recollection from my trip, however many years ago it was. My impression was that a lot of people in Chile really did not seem to understand why their country was more prosperous than a lot of other countries on the continent. Like, why were they more prosperous than Bolivia? The best, it seemed, well, we must be better people than the Bolivians. Like, they had no institutional explanation for what might account for this.
Right. It is true, and that has to do with what Hayek used to stress, which is the battle of ideas. The problem is we had this military regime, then we had the technocrats, they call them technocrats, or these economists that were trained at Chicago University, free marketeers, basically, who came back to Chile and started making all these reforms. And so they put an end to the price-fixing system, they put an end to the central plant economy, basically. And they replaced it by free market institutions. And the result was the Chilean miracle, and that poverty fell from 50% to 7%, and per capita income quadrupled, and many other indicators I could name you improved substantially. But people don't know this because we didn't have, let's put it this way, we didn't have a Mises Institute explaining to the people all the time that the reason why Chile works is because we have the highest index of economic freedom in the whole region. And so people forget about this, especially millennials who didn't, you know, experience all the disaster of the socialist regime from Allende. And so people think, okay, it's normal that we have, you know, supermarkets and malls and everything. And they give it for granted, but it's not. We all know it's not. We all know it's the work of the market. And when the market works and you have individual freedom and you have entrepreneurs, you know, being driven by profit motive and by passion and all these things that, of course, are also important, then you create wealth. And this is something I've been very engaged in Chile, in the public debate, television, everywhere, trying to explain to people, because it's very easy to fall again into this trap, the socialist trap, where people come, these populists come, and they tell you, okay, you will not have to work anymore. I will just take money away from the rich and I will give you things for free. And this is what is going on right now in Chile. And of course, it's not the only country in the world but where this is going on, but it's a huge problem right now. And so we have a presidential election next year, and many candidates are really leaning, you know, towards this kind of redistributionist policies, which we all know are very harmful. So I hope that we will continue our successful path so in the future, but there is no guarantee. And, you know, in Latin America, everything is possible.
I have had several people, libertarians, say to me, whatever good you can say about Pinochet is clearly overwhelmed by the human rights abuses, because it doesn't matter how much he freed markets. If a single person died, it can't be justified. And that's where they leave it. What do you think about that?
I think that's a nonsensical argument. I don't know. I mean, would they rather have a dictator that, besides from, you know, human rights abuses, leaves a disaster, an economic disaster as a legacy? Like, would they go for Castro rather than Pinochet? Because Castro, we all know that Cuba is a disaster economically, that people are you know, have no access to basic goods and all this, and we all know that the healthcare system is a myth, and all these things are basic lies that you see replicated in the New York Times everywhere. But we all know this is not true. And when he dies, everyone speaks about the great Fidel, and even Obama didn't dare to say something against him. But when you go to Pinochet, who, of course, they were many cases, but let's put the things in perspective. According to the official records of the Chilean democratic government, under Pinochet, a little more than 3,000 people were killed. 3,000, most of them between 1973 and 1975. The justification for this was fighting against terrorism, Marxism, and all this. Okay, and this is, of course, terrible. It happened. But when it comes to Fidel Castro, according to Project Cuba, it's about 100,000 people, human rights abuses. And on top of that, you have a disastrous economic legacy, and people cannot even leave the island if they want. Under Pinochet in Chile, you had many problems, but you could leave Chile anytime you wanted. It was not illegal to have dollars. You could start your own business anytime you wanted. You could sell whatever you wanted. You could buy whatever you wanted. You could, you know, you had not a fully free press, but also media that criticized the regime heavily. And you had organizations that opposed the government. You had political parties that opposed the government. Actually, they came later when he lost the referendum, they came into power. And so you could sell everything you wanted. You could buy anything you wanted. And basically, you were free to pursue your own ends. And with no heavy repression from part of the government. The repression under the Chilean military regime, it existed. Of course, it existed, but was basically focused on groups that the regime thought they were a threat to their power or to the social order, basically left-wing groups and left-wing associated people. But the average person was not usually involved in this kind of misconduct or misbehavior or crimes committed by members of the military regime. So when people say to me that nothing justifies the human rights abuses, of course nothing justifies it. But the thing is, you have to be able to do an objective analysis, and history is much more complex than saying nothing justifies something. We had Cold War, the Chilean economy collapsed under Allende, and I have to remind people that Allende was accused by the Chilean parliament of violating, of abusing human rights too, of using the police, the secret police, and all these institutions to go after people who opposed the regime. And many people were killed by terrorist groups that were supported by the Allende regime. So this is not a one-sided story. It's not only on the one side that the crimes were committed. It was also from the other side, from the left, many crimes were committed. And I have to remind people that one of the highest officials of the Socialist Party, the Chilean Socialist Party, Clodomiro Almeida, he was speaking about more than 1 million people that had to die in Chile in order to make the socialist revolution work. These were the terms that they were speaking at the time. And so, of course, there was, as I said, a sort of civil war, a pre-civil war. And when you have that, what do you want me to say? I mean, these things, horrible things happen. Now, I would ask these libertarians if they had preferred a communist dictatorship for Chile or a civil war with 1 million dead people, as the socialists were saying. It would happen, or if they had preferred that Pinochet would have been a dictator that ruined the country's economy even more. And so more people suffer and more people are, victim of this regime. And I don't think anyone in his right mind could argue for that, especially if you take into account the fact that it was the free market miracle that we had in Chile, so-called miracle, because I don't think it's a miracle because free markets work. But they called it miracle, the free market that enabled the reintroduction of democracy and a working democracy in the 90s and even after that. So if you had not had this economy that was growing at 7% per year, democracy would have been very unstable and we would have fallen again into a situation where you would have had a lot of violence. So I don't think it's that easy. Tom, I mean, they make it very easy to themselves when they say that. But that's not really a serious historical analysis, in my opinion.
We've talked about human rights abuses, but we've just spoken about them in that way. Can you just describe for me what exactly we're talking about? What is it that Pinochet did that you say, look, I don't defend this, this is no good? What are we talking about exactly?
Well, they were, of course, people that were tortured. They were missing people, so they sometimes the security police would come, take people away, and then you would never find out if they killed them, what they did with them. And then some of them were actually killed and then thrown into the ocean, the Pacific Ocean. I'm not saying all of them were innocent in the sense that they were not engaging in revolutionary activities or terrorist activities, but I'm sure some of them were innocent. And so the Rettig report is called the official document where these casualties were registered, and they did the whole work of trying to determine how they were killed and how many people died. And this was done in the 90s. So when we had democracy, back democracy. So the Rettig report shows about 3,000 people that were killed under Pinochet and a couple of hundred military members of the military as well. So there were not only people who died from the left-wing side of the spectrum or civilians, but also people in uniform. You know, we usually also forget that people in uniform also have human rights. So there was this confrontation, this fight between these socialist armed groups that had been supported by the Soviet Union and Cuba, and you had on the other side the military regime and the Chilean military that, of course, was better prepared for war, and then they had less casualties, but still. So what happened then under Pinochet is of course, that the control was in the hands of the military. And many things could have been prevented. I think it was not necessary to make people disappear, to kill them, to torture them. So I think this was complete, abuse of power. I don't think that was necessary or justified in any way. Although some people do justify it, but I don't agree with them. And from that perspective, I think this is not defensible. So yes, this is tragic, but it is also what happens when military run a country. Military people are trained to kill people, not to dance or to do things like this. So in the end, the responsibility is also from the political class that destroyed the country, and power more or less fell upon the shoulders of the military in Chile. That's the reality. And so what do you expect from militaries, from soldiers and generals and military people? And in the logic of the Cold War, we don't have to forget that. We had the Soviet Union massively intervening in Chile. This was also perceived as a serious threat by the Chilean military. And they reacted to this, and they overreacted to this, and so crimes were committed. Now, I'm not saying all people who were killed in this were innocent, because as I repeat, many of them were involved in terrorist groups, had also killed people, had also tortured others, had killed civilians in terrorist attacks and all this. So it is a little bit more complex than what is usually said in the media and so on. But what strikes me all the time, Tom, is that no one can justify what happened in terms of human rights abuses, of course. But how and why is it the case that Fidel Castro can get away with murder, literally, and no one says anything? And he is considered a great leader, not only by President Bachelet in Chile, who is a socialist president right now, but even by Jean-Claude Juncker in the European Union, and then you have the Prime Minister of Canada speaking highly of Castro, and even Obama doesn't say anything to condemn Castro. And if you go to the New York Times, for example, and the way they reported the death of Pinochet, he died when he was 91, and then the way they reported Castro's death is so obviously biased in favor of Castro that you really wonder if these people really care about human rights at all, or they only care when, you know, it's convenient to their own agenda. And I'm speaking about the New York Times because it's a clear example, but there are many other newspapers or commentators or politicians who make this distinction. And I don't think Fidel Castro was better than Pinochet in any way, not from an economic point of view, not from a human rights perspective. He stayed there 60 years and gave power to his brother. He died like a monarch, you know, and all that. So, and over 100,000 people died under his regime. That's according to Project Cuba. In Chile, it's 3,000 something, according to the RETI report. So I don't know how some people can speak very strongly against Pinochet, but when it comes to Fidel Castro, they tend to say, yes, but look at their success in healthcare, at their success in education, which we all know are lies, and so on. So that's only to I'm mentioning this because it's really interesting to notice this double standard when it comes to one or the other. And we have to condemn human rights violations or liberty or the abuse of liberty everywhere with the same strength. And this is something you don't see happening.
Yeah, so you're saying that it sounds like people who are concerned about human rights abuses in Chile are not universally concerned about them. They seem to have a selective kind of concern. That seems to be true in a lot of cases. But the Castro case, of course, is the most extraordinary and appalling one of all. The mass media is involved in it. In the United States, they were fawning over Castro. It defies belief. Before I let you go, tell me about the foundation that you're with in Chile. Tell me what it is and what it's all about.
Well, it's a think tank. It's called Foundation for Progress, and we are basically trying to spread classical liberalism and make it popular through different means. We use a lot of technology. We, of course, also published books by Hayek, Mises, Rothbard, and other thinkers that are not really widely read in Chile or in Latin America, for that matter. And many of these books are in English, and most people here don't speak English, so we have to translate them to make them available, you know, for the public. We focus a lot on students at the university level, school level, so they are, you know, not intoxicated by these collectivist beliefs so early on. And we are fully supported by... Our support or funding is private, so we don't get a penny from the government. Of course, we wouldn't accept it. And I started this a couple of years ago with a couple of business people who read the book I wrote, what's called The Fatal Ignorance. I was a little bit inspired in Hayek's Fatal Conceit, but the other way around. I was arguing that the ignorance on the right side of the spectrum or the classical liberal side of the spectrum, I don't think it's the same, but to put it in political terms, was that they were not aware of the importance of the battle of ideas and culture and the use of language and all this, which is in the end, and this is something I learned from reading Hayek, basically, it is in the end what drives social evolution and economic evolution and political evolution. So, and I've been, for example, we have been very inspired in the Mises Institute in the US, also in we have also connections to the Cato Institute and others. So so we are basically defending the ideas of classical liberalism and trying to explain people that that's the not only the best way to live in material terms, but also the most moral way to have social order, you know, based on individual liberty and not commands or orders given you by the government or by some politician.
What's the website?
So it's fppchile.org.
Okay.
fppchile.org. Unfortunately, we have not translated things to English yet. We have a couple of interviews that are interesting. We interviewed Deirdre McCloskey, for instance, and other people we invite to Chile, and those are in English, but not many documents we have published so far are in English, but we are working on that right now.
I have a global audience with many Spanish speakers listening, I'm very happy to say, and I know some of them will be delighted to check out your site, the site of the foundation. I'm linking to it at tomwoods.com/812. This has been pretty helpful, I would say, this discussion, and I appreciate it very much, and we'll have to talk again. I enjoyed our conversation.
Sure. I mean, I'm here. You can call me anytime. It was very nice speaking to you.
All right, that's our episode for today. Thanks so much for listening.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.